Well, we are continuing tonight in our study of the very timely message that we find in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's amazing to me each week as I delve into this great book that even though it was written over 900 years before Christ, around 930, 935, 940 years before Christ, it sounds like to me as if it could have been written today, because our world is full of people trying to find meaning and purpose in life just the way Solomon was through various pursuits. And that tells me that his desire for this, for meaning and purpose, is not something related to people who only lived centuries ago. It applies to people today. And the types of things he pursued, the categories, are the same today. The same basic things people pursue today in hopes of validating their existence. Well, we're in chapter 2 tonight. Last week, we studied chapter 1, verses 12, all the way through chapter 2, verse 11. And in that long section, chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 11, we noted the first two paths that Solomon pursued in his search for meaning, his search for purpose. And we saw that both of those paths ended up being dead-end streets for him. Just to review a little bit, we saw the first dead-end road. That was starting at chapter 1, verse 12. The pursuit of wisdom, this dead-end road he was on in pursuing wisdom, as if wisdom was going to bring meaning and purpose in his life. But if you look at verses 17 and 18, there's the conclusion of that path. Chapter 1, verse 17, "And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realize that this also is striving after wind. Because in much wisdom, there's much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain." So that was a dead-end road. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 11 is the pursuit of sensual-type pleasure. And I said last week, sometimes we load that word sensual with only sinful kinds of ideas. But it's a broader word than that. It has a broader meaning. Sensual just means anything that appeals to the senses. There are a lot of good things that appeal to the senses. But the problem is that pleasure that he would get from his senses, again, he was looking for meaning in it and purpose. And in this passage, verses 1 to 11 of chapter 2, we see in verses 2 to 3 last week that he experimented, which is what he was doing. He literally came to say in verse 1 that I'm going to test this. I'm going to test these different things. I see other people doing them, and they're happy, so I'm going to do it. I'm going to test it and go through an experiment and see if it works for me. So he tested or experimented with mirth or fun and laughter and pleasure, he says in verse 2. In verses 4 to 6, he experimented with all kinds of projects, especially building projects and land improvement projects. And so it was quite a change there from the first one. You know, laughter, we're literally in the palace. He had hired comedians and parties and great feasts with food. I mentioned to you some of the other passages in Scripture where it says the amount of food that the palace consumed every day. And experts today look at that and say that it was enough food to feed, 30 or 40,000 people daily. So he had great parties, great feasts with lots of laughter. And then he moved on into these building projects. And then in verses 7 to 8, he experimented with possessions. Maybe that would bring meaning. With music, the end of verse 8, if it's translated correctly, it's concubines, not musical instruments, concubines. He experimented with sex. 7 and 8, all these things, testing. But what was the conclusion? Verse 11, once again, it's a dead-end road, verse 11. "Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was vanity, striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun." That brings us to verse 12 tonight, and we'll finish chapter 2, verses 12 through 26. Solomon, the preacher, he calls himself, he's continuing to journal for us, journal instruction for our benefit. And he says, verse 12, "So I turned to consider." It's a phrase that means I decided to turn in another direction as far as my thinking goes, to pursue some things in a way that I had not quite done yet. The idea is that even though some of the subjects are the same, the idea is that after all he'd experimented with, he knew he needed to make a decision about it. both paths had ended up in a dead-end road. So I turned to consider. That means I realize I've got to make a choice here. I've got to make a decision. What am I going to do? Which approach is the best option? Should I adopt the lifestyle that's marked by my wisdom? It was a dead-end path, but should I adopt that one? Should I adopt the path marked by folly, all the pleasure? That was a dead-end road, but should I go that way? Should I be a serious thinker, someone who uses my head, the wisdom route? Should I just let it all hang out, as we say, and just pursue this path of pleasure? I turn to consider that. Wisdom, madness, folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? We'll talk about that whole phrase right there just for a moment. This is a section of the book and this verse that is very difficult to translate. And there's been several attempts at it, and the translation I'm using says it that way. What will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? Just so you'll know, the words, if you have a translation similar to that, the words will, what will man do, both the word will and the word do are added. They're not in the text itself. They've been added. And so a translation, if it's added that, would have those words in italics. It literally is saying, what the man. It's the idea of what is the man. And it's very similar or analogous to that question that we find in Psalm 8, verse 4, where it asks the question, what is man? That's really more the idea, potentially, with this phrase here. What is man here? And the word for man is that Hebrew word Adam. Adam, A-D-A-M. That's where Adam gets his name. Adam means of the earth and ruddy looking, red, but it's of the earth, earthy. It's a word in Scripture that not only is a name for Adam, but it's a word for man. In the first few chapters of Genesis, it's the word literally for the male and not the female. Sometimes in Scripture it's used for the mankind. And in Ecclesiastes, the book here, it's a catchword. It occurs more than once, and it is the idea of the human being, the person who's descended from the original Adam. So it's really what is Adam? What is the man, the one who's descended from Adam? What's he to do? This word Adam for man then is conjuring up all that we inherited from Adam. What's the person who has inherited folly and mortality and futility and evil, all that humanity has inherited? That's what that word means. And because of that, some translators say the word for king there, which is the normal word for king in Scripture, Malak, in the Old Testament, that word king in this verse is possibly not referring to Solomon, but instead the king of humanity, the first Adam. One way to translate it is, what will Adam do who will come after the king Adam, the original Adam, the king of humanity? Except, we have the phrase, what has already been done. That phrase is up for grabs too, just so you'll know. The Hebrew word for done, what has already been done, is the same word that can be translated made or fashioned. You make something or fashion. In fact, this verb is actually plural. It's a plural form of it, which means more than one person is doing it. And so the phrase could equally be, whom they have already made. This whole phrase could say, what is man who comes after the original man, the king of humanity, Adam, whom they have already made? If it's translated that way, that plural, just so you'll know, is the same verb, the plural verb made that you find back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. When the Godhead, the persons of the Godhead said, let us make man in our own image, it's the same word in the plural form. Because of that, and because of all these things I'm telling you, and I'll wrap this up for you in just a second, I'm just giving you some things I have to deal with sometimes when I'm studying. Because of that, this whole sentence could be something like this. I turn to consider this. I have to make a decision. Is a human likely to come along who will be better than the original human, Adam, the king of all humans, whom the Godhead, the plural Godhead, made long ago, whom they made long ago, whom has already been fashioned long ago? That would be stating then, at this point, that there's very little chance that humans, anyone, is going to behave with any greater wisdom than their ancestor Adam did, who was made by God and placed in the garden and had a perfect existence. Now, many translators don't take that view, though, and so they see the king as referring to Solomon. That's, it's what's a person to do, what's the Adam, if you want to say that, what's any man to do who will come after the king, but it's meaning Solomon. And the point would be that man's quest for the real profit in life seems hopeless when the likes of somebody like Solomon, who had all the gifts, all the talents, and he had all the wisdom, he had all the money, every conceivable benefit to help him in this pursuit, if he comes up unsatisfied, what hope is there for any man that's going to come after him? So either one, whether it's what is man, what is the Adam, any descendant of Adam going to do who comes after Adam, what's he going to do? He's not any wiser than the original Adam was, whom God made. Or what's any man going to do who comes after Solomon? And Solomon had everything he needed to make good decisions. Well, just so you'll know, either way, the point ends up being the same. And the point is, whether it's referring to Adam's descendants who'd be no better, or Solomon and anybody who's coming after him who would be no better, could do no better, the point ends up being the same. Man will not find meaning in life in either of these paths, wisdom or folly. Either one. That's the ultimate point. The value of life has to lie in other venues besides wisdom, other venues besides the madness and folly. So he goes on to verse 13. And this verse ends up just being a very simple summary comparison of what had been tried so far. Verse 13, and I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. So as he turns to consider all this, he does come to this conclusion, initially at least. If he's going to choose one or the other, he realized that wisdom had the better grade over folly. Wisdom pulls ahead of folly in this experiment. Wisdom is superior to any of the acquisitions or the projects or the sensual pleasure, any of the pleasures secured from things. Of the two, the benefit of wisdom over folly, he says, is compared to the benefit of light over darkness. Light, for most people, is better than darkness. They prefer light. The point, then, is that at least the wise know where they're going, even if because of their wisdom and knowledge, they know that they're actually heading for trouble at the end. At least they know it because they're smart, they're wise, and they're knowledgeable. Fools, on the other hand, if they're not exercising wisdom in their pursuit, they're always going to be surprised by the things that happen in life. At least the wise person knows things are going to happen and is somewhat prepared for them. So he gives in verse 13 wisdom the nod here. As he turns to consider which path, wisdom gets the nod here over folly. Verse 14. He says, the wise man's eyes are in his head. In other words, the wise man can see farther ahead. And it's the idea of eyes that can look in many directions. That's sort of the point of the Hebrew phrase there. The eyes are in his head in such a way that he can see a lot of different directions. So he walks through life. We would say it this way. The wise person has his eyes wide open. Okay, that's the way he lives. And he has lots of clear thinking vision going on while he lives life. The fool, on the other hand, he's still contrasting the two. He operates as if he's in a dark room. He doesn't know what's going to happen next. He just goes from one experience to the next. He gropes. He wanders all about. So between the two, obviously, wisdom wins. Yet, into verse 14, I know that one fate befalls them both. So, is it really an obvious advantage? Is it really a permanent advantage? No, it's not. Can wisdom insulate us from the attack of death someday? And he says, no. When you look at that one, you plug that in the formula, wisdom and folly are the same. Verse 15, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. Yes, the wise man sees death coming. If you just want to talk about death for a moment, the wise man actually thinks about it. He knows death is coming. Folly, the fool lives as if it's not. He sees it's coming and he even contemplates it. And yes, it's better than the mindless tumble into death that you might visualize that a fool takes. But neither one can do anything to stop it. Both the wise and the fools are equal heirs of the mortality that we get from Adam because of Genesis chapter 3 and the fall. So let's put it in practical terms. So what if I get a fine education today? What if I get a master's degree? What if I go on and get a doctor's degree? What if I pursue a very responsible job in my life? What if I'm not a fool, but I'm really going to be responsible? What if I order my private world utilizing common sense so I'm not foolish? What if I decide to practice a profession of some sort or pursue a trade? I may live with my eyes wide open. I may raise a family. I may plan wisely for retirement. But the fact is, and this is basically what he said, when the axe falls on my neck just like it does the fool's. The axe doesn't discriminate. Like the fool, I'm going to die. And when once death comes, which one's more dead? The wise man or the fool? They're the same. Same amount of deadness. And the awareness of this became very personal here with his language. Verse 15, I said to myself, I'm not just talking about those wise people and those fools out there. I'm talking about me. As is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Even me is the idea. So I said to myself, this too is vanity. He's realizing personally that all his wisdom had given him no advantage over the fool. He's going to be no less dead than a drunk, no less dead than a prostitute, no less dead than a thief. Verse 16, for there's no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how will the wise man and the fool alike die? You see, the smart person, the intellectual, the wise person, the one who's sought to gain as much knowledge as they can, that somehow there's going to be meaning and purpose in that, his real hope is that somehow he can leave a mark, that he'll achieve lasting fame, or he'll be remembered long for his contributions. The fool doesn't even think that way. It's just whatever the next pleasure is, let's just eat, drink, and be merry. But the intellectual, the wise person, the knowledgeable person is thinking something deeper than that. And so the preacher, Solomon calls himself, pronounces all this to be an illusion. Future generations will no more remember the scholar than they will the beggar on the street. Both die. Both are forgotten by everyone. Granted, a few history buffs pay attention to all the forgotten people of history. Okay, and we may remember a few names, relatively speaking, but the vast majority, all forgotten. You don't know who they are. So Solomon is just really revealing to us, very honestly in his journal, at this point in his discoveries, his experiments, that he's very disillusioned. And he's even bitter because he's so disappointed. Verse 17. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. He's saying, if this is all there is, and if the wise man and the fool die alike, and if they're equally and alike forgotten, then life is a cheat. It has cheated me. I have been deluded. All my life, I thought that I was pursuing this grand task in my quest for wisdom and exercise of wisdom. But I realized all the time, I was just trying to catch wind. And he can't do it. Life played a trick on me. All my efforts destined for oblivion. All the labor spent in acquiring wisdom gives him ultimately no advantage. very discouraging picture. Again, we can make this practical. We can work and we work and we can work. We can think. We can strategize. We can plan. We can sacrifice. We can compete. We can travel around the world. We can worry about things. We can maybe even skip vacations to pursue things that maybe are going to be more important somehow, and we can add hours to our jobs, and we can increase our responsibility at our jobs. We can get to know the right people. We can scratch the right backs. We can invest our money. We can save. We can even risk something here and there to make more. Again, we can work. We can work. We can work. We can get everything in place. And you and the beggar on the street are equally dead. You see, people, and this is really what Solomon wants people to do, people have to examine what they're really hanging on to that's important, what they're planning, what their future plans are all about. Because all of it will seem very and terribly irrelevant when you face the fact that you're going to be reduced to death in just a brief span of time. I like what one commentator, Derek Kidner, wrote. It's the imagery of playing cards. If every card in our hand is going to end up being trumped, then it doesn't really matter how we play. Now, if you play spades or something like that, you know what that means. You know, you can strategize and you can bid and you can have what you think is a good hand and you can play wisely. And there's this person that somehow ended up with a lot of spades in their hands, and they just keep trumping all your strategy. Yeah, but you know, for what I had, though, I really played wisely. I mean, if you could have seen the hand I had, you know, I really did a good job making the most out of my hand. Doesn't matter. They trumped everything. That's the idea. So, if wisdom and pleasure are both dead entrails in the search, he goes on. Verse 18, perhaps then, I'm taking the wrong approach. Perhaps what I need to do is not to try to build up wealth for myself and pleasures for myself. I need to think long term. I need to think about legacy. I need to think about posterity. I need to think about my children and my grandchildren. Perhaps there's satisfaction and meaning knowing that if I have gained material possessions or knowledge or anything, but especially now he's going to talk about material things and money. If I have that and I've laid up well for the others who are going to follow me, I've done it for someone else, maybe that's noble enough that I'll find purpose in that. I'll leave a legacy. Forget whether it ended up good for me or not, but I can work and work and work and strategize and invest and save my money and think about retirement and buy land and have a house and all that so that my children are taken care of. I mean, that's a noble thing to do. So that's what he thinks. And he thinks about that. He evaluates that. But he's a very wise man. So he takes it to another level of evaluation. And he realizes that, yes, you're right. One day, all my estate is going to fall into the hands of my sons and daughters. You know, that's the way it works. So the question is that going to work, though, as far as meaning goes? Purpose. Well, regrettably, in verses 18 to 21, he concludes, this is no solution either. There's some problems with this. Verse 18. Therefore, I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to the man who will come after me. This word labor or toil is kind of a term that definitely segues quickly. We're away from wisdom now, and we're back talking about possessions, you know, something else. So that word accomplishes that. And but the term is not just referring to the work. It's a Hebrew term that is used in this context to refer not just to the labor itself, but all the fruit of the labor, all the wealth that could potentially come with it, all the possessions. The land, the savings. It's all that goes with it, the result of my toil. And he says, what I hated was not just my labor, but even the fruit of the labor. That's the word, if you're going to translate it correctly. It's the fruit of the labor. I hated even that. So it's not just the working that disgusts me, but the fact that I'm going to leave the result of my labors, my earnings, to others. I mean, it would be fine if I had the guarantee that my legacy is going to continue and that ever all my values, all the lessons I've learned are going to continue, and all that I've taken care of and protected, my money, my investments, my land, my house, that the next generation is going to do it the same way. But the problem is, when he says, I've got to leave it to the man who will come after me, there's a question begged there. And who knows what they're going to do with it? I have no guarantee that they're going to take care of it. They could squander it. And then all my work and labor is for nothing. Verse 19. So give all your money to the local church. No, it doesn't say that, but I was just thinking. That's a different translation, but verse 19. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I've labored by acting wisely under the sun. I mean, I've been wise. I worked hard. But he's going to have control over it. And is he a wise man or a fool? So the point is, finding meaning in this approach is also vanity. Working for your own profit, he's already found out that that was meaningless. He had all the possessions and he still had no meaning. But if I give it to someone else, maybe I'll get meaning in that. But here Solomon rejects the view that life is made worthwhile by working to provide for your children, or more generally, for posterity. If you're trying to accomplish things for posterity, it still doesn't add up to anything. Because the fact is, like I said, there's no way of knowing whether that inheritance is going to be used wisely or not. Who knows how long it will be before the family fortune is squandered? See, this is the reality. No matter how capable, let's just take children, no matter how capable, how competent, how perfectly suited they may be to continue your dream for your stuff, there's something in you that you can't pass on to them. I mean, there's something about you and your thinking and your goals and your dreams and your values of life. There's something there that's not passed on that they'll never possess because they're your dreams. They're not going to share them exactly the same way you do. And even if it seems they do when they're young, they too, as time goes on, are going to mature. They're going to age. They're going to change. They're going to go through epochs of life after you're long dead. Regardless of the promises they make to you, they're going to come to another era of their lives and they're going to reevaluate where they are. They go, you know what? The family homestead, the house, it just doesn't fit in with us anymore. They sell it to somebody else. It's gone. The homestead's not as appealing to them then. So no matter how closely you've had your children work alongside you, so they share your dreams and your vision and your values, there will always be something about you, something you've got that they'll lack. But let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, you've really done a good job. You've trained them well. And they've maybe written it into the contract somehow. Yeah, but what about their children? Let's say they do hold on to it all and make it even bigger. And they've taken your values and they bought even more land and they've kept the house and all that you passed on to them. They also got a good degree or whatever it is. Yeah, but then there's another generation that they're going to leave it to. Yeah, what about the grandchildren? I mean, that next generation after them, it's very possible that there's going to be greed when it comes to family possessions. Do you know how common that is? Goodness. I mean, some of the ugliest things that ever happened in the world, besides some church business meetings, are family business meetings where, you know, a china cabinet is being discussed. You don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I'm just elaborating on this because this is what's going through his mind, actually. I mean, he's thinking there's going to be some purpose in this noble effort of leaving it all. So keep making it because I can leave it to someone else. We just don't have a way of knowing what's going to happen. We don't even have a way of knowing this, of what tangibly he might have been thinking of. I know the end of the story, but at this point in his life, it's very possible he's already thinking about his son, Rehoboam. Rehoboam ended up being a very tragic story, Solomon's son. I mean, here's Solomon ruling over the kingdom, 4 decades of peace. I mean, his father David followed the wars. Solomon gets to enjoy 40 years of peace and prosperity. He hands the kingdom over to his son, Rehoboam. Rehoboam took the kingdom from his father, and he started getting advice, and he had 2 sets of people he could listen to, wise people and foolish. So guess which ones he listened to? He listened to the foolish advisors, and within a brief span of time, hardly even a year of having the kingdom, the country was in civil war. That's how quickly it happened. And then Egypt came. They came marching in. And Rehoboam's thinking, okay, I gotta appease them somehow. So he went to the temple. Whose temple was it, by the way? Solomon's temple. He took all the gold, the solid shields of gold that were in there that his father had placed there, and he handed them all over to the Egyptians to keep them from invading. And he's thinking that by just filling their coffers, you know, with all this Israelite gold, the gold his dad had made, the gold he had put in the temple, by giving it all to the Israelites, Rehoboam hoped to calm their aggressions. It was all a joke. I mean, as expected, the Egyptians aren't dumb. They kept wanting more then. I mean, it was a tragic story. That's his son. Maybe Solomon was already seeing some very concerning things in his son, and he came to this sober realization about what could happen with all of his possessions once he was dead. The result of the realization, verse 20, therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Back at square one in the futility game here. His point is that he came to the decision that he would, I'm no longer going to live. This is what he's saying. I'm not going to live by this myth anymore that working for myself will give me pleasure. Working to pass on things, that that'll give me pleasure. I'm not going to live by the myth that hard work and hard-earned wealth is going to validate my life, because hard-earned wealth does not validate anybody's life. This is a very common pursuit. I said at the beginning, this could have been written today. The obsession with fulfillment through work and accomplishments ultimately ends up leading to this crisis point in a person's life where the person's going to realize that their whole life was just lived for nothing. Verse 21. When there's a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his labor, his legacy, to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. See, it's not even, he says, it's not even just the possessions I'm passing on. He points out that the labor was with wisdom and knowledge and skill. So that's being passed on as well. The example of the wisdom, the skill, the knowledge, the intelligence by which he had acquired all of that. Not only is my once I die, not only are my possessions all meaningless to me, but all the wisdom and skill and intelligence is meaningless to me at that point as well. Again, put it in modern day terms. A person can be a great businessman and it can end up meaning nothing. 22. For what does a man get in all his labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? This is a conclusion of what we call the first section of the book. Chapter 3 is going to be starting another section of the book. But he's concluding now, and this is part of that conclusion. What does a man get for all of his labor? You know what? That's the same as where we started, chapter 1, verse 3. It's the same question. Chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? Verse 22. What does a man get in all his labor, in striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days, verse 23 says, because all his days, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. It's as if he's saying that, okay, Perhaps there's going to be a little rest, though. I can get out of the rat race, we call it, of trying to do all this. Go home, let my hair down, prop my feet up. Maybe there's some relief in the evening. Not for the person who's consumed with all this. If you're consumed with your job, if you're consumed with wealth, if you're consumed with passing on something, if you're consumed with trying to find meaning and purpose in my job and my identity like that and what I'm making and my salary and advancement, if I'm trying to find meaning in that, there will be no relief even in the evening. I mean, he thinks he's going to take time off to do other things. The reality is that those who are seeking to find meaning this way, they don't really do it. I mean, how many entrepreneurs do you know who really, I mean, really kick back in the evening? You know? I mean, can you name, honestly, some success-driven people? I'm talking about people obsessed with success and wealth and making money and increasing it and owning more and having more and gaining more knowledge. How many that's driven like that leave everything at the office at 5 o'clock and go home and don't think about it anymore? You see, this person is driven there too. Most people who are at the top or they're climbing to try to get to the top, they do bring all kinds of work home from the office, mentally or tangibly. And the point is, for this kind of person, not even at night do we put our minds in neutral. Because it's consuming. He's painting the picture here of himself that he was burning himself up for stuff that just had no real value, no real purpose and meaning. Day and night, there was toil of body and mind for Solomon. It was all vanity. So it's clear, man does not possess anything within himself or outside himself to aid him in all these pursuits to find happiness. So what do we do? How can we make it then? Since everything is futility, everything's empty, we're now able to and ready, really, to receive the hard-hitting aspect of his conclusion, verses 24 to 26. It's as if he gets this flash of insight that grabs his attention. He says this: there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. Literally, it says this: there is nothing in man, is actually the point. There's nothing within man. There's nothing in him. That's better, really, than this thing about there's nothing better for a man. But there's nothing in man, when it comes to eating and drinking, that's going to tell himself, that's going to convince himself that his labor is good. Nothing within him. There's nothing inherent in humanity. Nothing in the man himself to eat and to drink. Nothing within himself that's going to make it possible in the eating and drinking or in the other pursuits, make it possible for him to get enjoyment from it, to extract enjoyment from it. It doesn't matter what the pursuit is. The problem is man. And whether he eats or drinks, nothing is going to ever come to a place where he's going to get enjoyment from it. Hebrew there is very complicated, but that's what it means. There's nothing within you or your children or your grandchildren that's going to automatically give you happiness, automatically keep you at peace, automatically bring you joy. But he gives some counsel now. And his counsel is this: you should enjoy life. You should seek to enjoy the things that you have. But the enjoyment is not something that is from within you. It is a gift from God. It is God's personal gift to a person to be able then to find meaning and happiness and joy in life. The ability to enjoy things, the ability to use the good things of life, even material things, the ability to enjoy it is a gift from God. So why do people not find it? Because God hasn't given them that gift. They're trying to find it within themselves. They're trying to find it in their own pursuits, their own definitions of life, their own intellect, their own wisdom, their own possessions, their own evaluations, their own experiments. Just like Solomon did. So he's saying, it's not within me, it's not within you. This I have seen, it is from the hand of God. Unless God is at the center of it, in the middle of it, at the beginning of it, in the end of it, unless God is in the very center of everything, lasting enjoyment is impossible. Now, as Christians, we know this to be true. We can enjoy life. We can have fun in life. I mean, there's no better place to be than with other Christians who get together to enjoy each other's fellowship, to have fun, to enjoy each other's company, to enjoy life together. In fact, Solomon's really saying this, those who belong to God should above all others have the capacity to enjoy life. In our context, it's Christians. In his context, it's the people of God. The people of God, those who belong to Him, above all others, should be living in this life with joy and fulfillment and purpose because God's given them that gift. The opposite is true as a bottom line, verse 25. Who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? And their answer is, no one. That's the problem. Life is empty without God. It is empty. Most people now have this backwards. Most people have the idea that it's the world and all these things we've already talked about, that's what gives enjoyment. And God is the one who hates for you to be happy and is ready with a club to club you if you're having fun and enjoying life. That's sort of the image of God. God is there to make us miserable. God is there with rules and regulations that rob us of fun. We can't do that because God won't let us, and so we can have no fun. That's the way the world sees it. Entirely backwards. The fact is, it's the other way around. Now, I'm using that word fun in the best sense of it. If you really want to have fun in life, if you want to have meaning in life, purpose in life, if you want to have fun, the kind of fun that is deep-seated, real enjoyment with no hangovers, you need one ingredient and one ingredient only. A relationship with the living God who created you. That's it. And then the job is totally different. The money means something totally different. All those things that he found, tried to find pleasure in, music. Music becomes something totally different. And the joy it gives you. Art. Projects. Building projects. Land improvement. Gardening projects. They take on a whole new meaning. Because I have a relationship with the living God. And as God's people, we're the ones that ought to be having the time of our lives. I'm convinced of that. We should be having the time of our lives. I'll be honest about my observation about way too many Christians. And I'll be very frank with you, though my name is not Frank. Not just too many Christians, especially Baptists. Okay? I are one. Okay? So I can say it. I think too many were baptized in lemon juice instead of water. Somehow that got mixed in the water. And life is viewed as something to avoid, something to be fearful of, something to... I've got to create then all these rules and regulations to keep me from enjoying life. Because if I'm enjoying life, maybe something's wrong. Listen. It's going to come up again in the book. We should be having the time of our lives. The problem is if we think those things are where we find our purpose. We find our purpose in our relationship with the Lord. And that changes all these things. In verse 26, he has one more thought. And I'm going to do my best to explain this because it's a very interesting statement. For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner, that's the person who doesn't belong to the Lord, while the lost person, to the lost person, he is given. Now get this. To his own people, he's given. He gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. To the lost people, those who don't belong to him, he is given a task. Now, they don't know this, but from God's perspective, this is the way it is. He's given them the task of gathering and collecting, working, doing stuff, building stuff, creating stuff, inventing stuff, making money, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight, in other words, the believer. Interesting statement. The point is this. Those who are right with God end up deriving then benefit from everyone else's labor who's pursuing it all for the wrong reasons and trying to find meaning in it. The world thinks it's building its fortune for itself. The world thinks it's accumulating wealth for itself and or maybe for posterity. But ultimately, the Christian benefits from most of it. Now, it's a little difficult to explain how this happens in every situation. But the idea is this. The lost of the world, by God's common grace, have skills. They have intellect. They have wisdom. They have building skills. They have medical skills. They have cooking skills. They have mechanical skills, etc. And they go about using those skills and those talents, and they think they are pursuing those things for meaning and purpose in their own lives. Even if it's something that helps the world in some way, they may have that noble idea. But even there, they believe they're helping the world, but it's by helping the world then they find fulfillment for themselves. So ultimately, it's to find purpose for themselves. And they think that the things they build or discover or create or cook are things they personally are going to get satisfaction out of in life and joy in. But this verse is actually saying that all the things they're doing are really for the benefit of us, God's people. So enjoy them. Take advantage of them. Next time you buy a car or house or some clothes, think about this. The odds are that some unbelievers were involved in the creating of it. Their skills played some role in producing it. They got paid for it. It was their job. They thought they were doing it for themselves all the time. God sovereignly gave them their job and their skills for the benefit of his own people. They're all out there working for us. That's very interesting. I'll make it practical for me. I'm watching a football game. And athletes are there manifesting their athletic skills. And all those thousands of people are also watching and enjoying of it. Most of them lost. Here's what I'm thinking. This game's really for me. I'm just letting all those lost people enjoy it as well. They're borrowing some of the enjoyment. But I and other Christians are the ones who can really enjoy it. Because we know the Creator who gave them their skills. We know the one who made the stadium. We know the one who created even the idea of it and placed it in people's minds. We know Him. Therefore, we can enjoy that at a far deeper and more profound level than anyone else. Some more examples. When I see someone driving a truck like mine, I can think this based on this verse. Well, they bought one. Okay. Like mine, that's okay. I'll let them think that the automaker made this type of truck for them. But the fact is, God allowed this truck to be made for Christians to buy and to enjoy and to use. It's just that by His common grace, others are going to benefit from it also. Go to a restaurant, enjoy a good steak. Ecclesiastes would promote that. Go out and enjoy a good steak. Really enjoy it. And the next time you're there, just be thinking about this, though, that it's a restaurant with skillful cooks, and they all exist for your enjoyment because you belong to the Lord. Lost people who are there are just being allowed to get a taste of it. It's really for us. To a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom, knowledge, and joy. While to the sinner, he's given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who's good in God's sight. We benefit from all these things ultimately. Listen, enjoy the things that life has to give. There are things that are from God for us to enjoy, but it's only possible if you love the Lord first. And obedience to Him is at the heart of what's driving you in life. Love for Him and obedience to Him, it drives you in life. Go back to verse 25. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? No one. No one. It says at the end of verse 26, those who are out gathering, collecting, for them, it's vanity, striving after wind, but not for the person who knows God. It's not chasing wind. It's not futility. It changes my job. I'm not trying to find fulfillment in my ministry. If I start trying to find fulfillment in my ministry as a pastor, here's what happens. The Ecclesiastes principle kicks in. It's unfulfilling. There's some things about it, I'll be honest with you, I don't care for. In fact, I can say that about every job I've ever had. There's something about it that's unfulfilling. But in the Lord, it's a whole new perspective. Nothing is wasted. God has His purposes. And because I know Him, I can look at the opportunity He's given to me. And it doesn't matter whether you're in the ministry of the pastor, whether you're working as a businessman, whether you're a salesman, whether you're an inventor, a doctor, a nurse. It doesn't matter. Now it takes on a whole new meaning. But it'll tank, we say, if you ever let that flip in your mind that you think you're going to find fulfillment in those things. It's just a side note here in verse 26. You really see Solomon's understanding of the sovereignty of God. He's affirming God's complete sovereignty over everything. He points out how God is using those who are even opposed to Him. He uses them for His own purposes that He has. So the sovereignty of God is there in that verse. God uses even the lives of the wicked to achieve His purposes. So Solomon is not one who is living his life. I mean, when he ends up here at the right place, you know, as we see it unfold, he's not one living his life as if God is some sort of just fate that's out there. There's impersonal fate driving everything. And he's not describing even in verse 26, God is this erratic or whimsical or fickle kind of God. I mean, divine activity is not understood from Solomon's standpoint to be arbitrary, hopelessly arbitrary. Instead, God sovereignly manifests His grace in His dealings with people. He has plans and He has purposes and He works it all out. And He even uses the lost who are against Him, trying to find their fulfillment in the things He told them not to find their fulfillment in. He even uses them ultimately for His own people. So to believe that one's life is ruled by impersonal force, that's a horrible way to live. But to believe that life is controlled by a personal God, that's a comfort. So the conclusion of 24 to 26 is this. Purpose of life cannot be found in any one of the good things found in the world. Doesn't matter what it is and how good it is. Health, riches, possessions, position, honors, prestige. They slip through our hands unless we receive them as a gift. If we strive and strive and strive to find within ourselves the way to do it, the Ecclesiastes principle kicks in. If we do what God's told us to do and we trust Him and we receive the fruit of it, whether it's health or riches or possessions or whatever it might be, we receive it from Him as a gift, then there's joy. Because God has to give us the ability to enjoy it. I don't think anybody can even understand and appreciate even elementary things like eating and drinking, this passage talks about. Apart from a personal relationship with the Lord. Even those mundane activities, eating and drinking, become something that give us pleasure and joy because it's a gift from God. Now we can answer the question of chapter 1, verse 3. Or how it's repeated in verse 22 of chapter 2. Now we can answer it. It's all meaningless. What advantage does somebody have? Nothing in and of themselves, but God gives meaning. God gives the ability to enjoy life. For those who fear Him, for those who reverence Him, for those who love Him and believe Him, He gives them meaning and He gives them joy. And Solomon would tell us to enjoy it. Let's pray.